So tonight I'd like to talk about Bhojanga. And I'm not talking about the vaudeville dancer. I'm talking about, I'm probably mispronouncing it. It's a word that that stands for the seven factors of awakening, also called the seven factors of enlightenment. You know, the Buddha loved his lists. And a lot of people find this annoying. My sister calls this numerical Buddhism. But the Buddha used numbered lists all the time. And the reason that we usually hear for that is that this is a great mnemonic device. And you can see why. You know, some monks are hanging out and one says, Larry, I'm trying to think of what the seventh enlightenment factor is. I've got six of them here, and I know there's a seventh one. And, Dharma Vichaya. Okay, right, got it, all seven now. So it's sort of like it's a good way of checking if you actually remember all of a particular list. So anyway, the Buddha taught a lot in lists. Of the four collections of suttas, the four collections of discourses that we have, the Anguttara Nikaya, the Samyutta Nikaya, the Digha Nikaya, and the Majjhima Nikaya, the Anguttara Nikaya is all lists. It is a numbered list of numbered lists. So it starts off with the twos, and everything that is taught with two of this, two of that, there's that, and it goes through the threes, the fours, and so on. It's all numbered lists. So one of the reasons people believe that the Buddha taught this way was that this was a great mnemonic device. As I said, you know, Larry figured out that there were seven mnemonic factors, and so he had to keep counting his fingers. And the Buddha's teachings were transmitted orally across all of North India. This is a huge movement. There were thousands, tens of thousands of people all across Northern India, many of whom had never seen the Buddha speak. They were hearing his teachings third or fourth hand even, or further. And yet, they were transmitted with real rigor. We have reason to believe that that these were being transmitted without loss of or addition of information. And of course, part of it was this was not a literate culture. They did not, nobody wrote. Literacy rate was well under 1%, or even a tenth of 1%. So everything was transmitted orally. And so everything was transmitted in a way, and people just fell into the habit of speaking in a way that that was easy to memorize. And people in pre-literate cultures were much better at memorizing than people are today. They didn't have the written word to fall back on. But I think there's another reason why the Buddha used so many numbered lists. And I think it's because human beings just love numbered lists. If you don't believe me, look at Facebook. You have all these stupid numbered lists, and the idea is to get you to click on them so you go and see the advertisements. But this works. People do this. You know, you've got the 12 amazing facts about butter. You've got, you will be astounded by these 10 ways to annoy your Sangha. So, and you know, when you think about it, the seven factors of awakening is kind of a dull title. So I'm going to give it, if I post this on the website, if this turns out, post it on the website, it's going to get a flashy title like Seven Amazing Tips to Improve Your Brain. Exclamation point. I mean, that's a lot better than Seven Factors of Enlightenment, isn't it? Well, we'll see. So, the name, Seven Factors of Enlightenment. Whenever I hear something about enlightenment, I sort of get an uh-oh feeling. Because, you know, enlightenment is a great aspiration. And I really admire people who have it. And in an abstract way, I could sign up for that too. But I doubt I'm going to get enlightened anytime soon. I like my trivial pleasures and my lightweight entertainments too much, my adult beverages. And I'm not ready to renounce all of those. I'm not ready to take the robes. So here's what the Buddha says in one of his suttas about the seven factors. By the way, this is from the Samyutta Nikaya. The Samyutta Nikaya is a collection of suttas of discourses about specific topics. So it's a great research place. If you want to go look at a whole bunch of suttas about the seven factors of enlightenment, the Samyutta Nikaya, section 46, is a good place to go. Section 46 in the Samyutta Nikaya has more than 50 suttas on the seven factors of enlightenment. So I could choose any one of those, but I like this one. So this is a translation. This is 46.40. It's translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And of course, I've abstracted one piece out of it and edited heavily to get rid of some of the repetition. The Buddha speaking. These seven factors of enlightenment, bhikkhus, are makers of vision, makers of knowledge, promoting the growth of wisdom, free from vexation, leading towards nibbana. What seven? The enlightenment factor of mindfulness is a maker of vision, maker of knowledge, promoting the growth of wisdom, free from vexation, leading towards nibbana. And he repeats that formula for the other six. Investigation, energy, rapture, calm, concentration, and equanimity. And leading towards nibbana. These seven factors of enlightenment are makers of vision, makers of knowledge, promoting the growth of wisdom, free from vexation, leading towards nibbana. So what I'm reading from this is that there's a lot of ancillary benefits besides the possibility of full enlightenment. So makers of vision, okay, that sounds good. Makers of knowledge, promoting the growth of wisdom, that sounds great. Free from vexation, I particularly like that one. So, you know, I can sign up for all of these things. So what I like to think of about the seven factors of enlightenment is that these are qualities that help the mind work well. These are just ways to assist in the clarity and the good functioning of one's mind. When you develop these, your mind just works better. As opposed to the hindrances, and the hindrances are usually formulated as things that keep the mind from working well. That's why they're called hindrances. They get in the way. So how important are the seven factors of awakening? I just said that there are more than 50 suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya about the awakening factors. So that's a lot. Plus they show up in a lot of other suttas, like the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapanasati Sutta, and I'm not going to stop to try to explain what those are. But whenever you try to discuss anything in Buddhism, you find it's tied to everything else. So you have to step very lightly or you get lost in all kinds of side discussions. I'll do that anyway, but I will avoid some of them. It is also said that the seven factors has a healing power. Just reciting the seven factors is supposed to have a healing power. There, one of the suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya section has the Buddha going to visit a monk who is very, very sick and is probably dying. And at the monk's request, the Buddha recites the list of the seven factors of enlightenment, and the monk gets all better. He's healed completely. What's weird about this is that just a couple suttas later, there is another sutta that is exactly word for word identical in every single way, except that it's a different monk. Yeah, I sort of have to picture the Buddha going, now wait a minute, haven't we done this before? Deja vu? Right. So anyway. So let's talk about the factors themselves after all this build up. The first factor, and these are numbered and they are generally treated as sequential, although I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later on. The first of the factors is that is mindfulness. And the Pali word is sati. So we hear a lot about mindfulness. Mindfulness is really big this year. And it's made the cover of Time magazine. It's a really, really big deal. So I don't really need to say a whole lot about it, but I wanted to point out something that'll come up again later, is that we talk about mindfulness as the ability to be with your experience as it's arising, rather than your story about the experience. As we have a real tendency, rather than to see things as they are, we tend to tell ourselves stories about what we're seeing. We're sort of consciously or subconsciously narrating what we're seeing. And for those of you who have spent some time meditating, you may have had a few times of clarity where it just gets really quiet, the chattering mind settles down for a little while, and you just really notice that there's something quite a bit different about what you're actually seeing. And we can all get this momentary quiet. I found it kind of a neat, stupid-sounding trick, but it actually works for me, is when my mind is really chattering away, I just say, "Shut up in there!" And what's amazing is it actually works very briefly. And it'll be really quiet. And then I'll go, "Oh, wow, that was cool." And then, of course, it's all back. And then pat myself on the back for a great trick. So mindfulness is the ability to actually be with our experience and perceive it as it is. Not that thinking about things is a bad thing. It's just that we get sucked into it so much all the time that we tend to believe things that may not be true, may not actually be happening. Great example, I know this is a story that has been told by a number of teachers. There was an experiment done a couple of years ago. A group of people were shown a video of some kind of game, and they were supposed to count how many times a certain kind of event took place. And they were not told that partway through the video, a person in a gorilla suit would appear on the screen. And then afterwards, people were asked to report on how many times this event had taken place, and they had various numbers that they reported. And then they were asked about the guy in the gorilla suit, and nobody saw it. So I thought, oh, well, I'm sure the gorilla guy was very subtle, it would be hard to notice. I finally saw that video. There's nothing subtle about it. You cannot see the game because the guy's standing right in front. He walks across, turns, faces the camera, gestures wildly, and then walks off again. And yet nobody saw this because they were so busy thinking about what they saw or what they were supposed to see that they didn't see what was actually in front of them. And you can see this for yourself. You've probably been surprised sometimes at what actually turned out to be going on when you thought something else entirely was happening. So mindfulness, one of the things that I think happens when we do have these moments of mindfulness is that things look different. They're surprising. And for a lot of people, certainly for me, what comes up is curiosity. Wow, how does the mind do this? How does the mind work? What would happen if I placed my attention in a different way? So I think curiosity is a really important quality in spiritual practice. And years ago, Philip Moffat urged me to use my curiosity on a retreat, and I found it to be enormously helpful. And the reason I'm bringing curiosity up is because the second enlightenment factor, the word, the Pali word is dhammavicaya. It's one of those compound words. And that means investigation. It's usually translated as investigation of dhammas. Dhammavicaya. And so there are a couple ways you can look at that. But I think that investigation is just empty, or as Philip Moffat said, incredibly dreary without curiosity. And I take it a step further. If you're trying to do investigation without any curiosity about what you're investigating, then this is just an empty exercise. You're not going to get anything. It's like you're checking off the boxes. So somebody going through the seven factors of enlightenment and just saying, investigate the dhammas. Okay, you know, I don't really want to do this, but it says I got to, so I'm going to do them. Without curiosity, this is just a meaningless exercise. But with mindfulness, I think curiosity is something that arises very naturally. You start to become curious about the nature of the mind, the nature of perception. Curiosity can be a great fuel for all kinds of things. As an example, I'll talk about metta practice. For me, and I know for a number of people, metta practice, as is traditionally taught in the Theravada lineage, which, by the way, does not show up in the suttas. Only a very simplified version shows up in the suttas. But nonetheless, it's part of our tradition, where we visualize a recipient, maybe a benefactor or ourself, and we visualize this person, and we chant our way through the four different benefits that we want to confer to them, and we imagine them enjoying these things. And for me, this was like running home movies. I start imagining conversations with these people, and it got very thinky. I just couldn't get anywhere with it, and it just seemed like, you know, who could possibly do this for getting value out of this? So 5 or 6 years ago, I went on a metta retreat. So the nice thing about a metta retreat is for 7 days, I was around in an environment and in a context that encouraged metta practice, and I felt I had complete license to experiment. Which, you know, experimentation, like investigation, doesn't go anywhere unless you have some curiosity fueling it. So I was curious. So I was going, well, what happens if I drop this aspect of it and really downplay this other aspect of it and play up on the emotional aspect of it? Oh, that's interesting. What if I... And then after the second day, I found a version of the metta practice that really worked for me. And now I'm a huge fan of metta. Remember, years ago, Philip Moffat said, Bill, you should work on your metta project. And I was going, oh, no, please don't tell me that. And now I'm a big fan, and I would urge all of you to work on it. But I would also urge you to find some curiosity about it, because it may not click for you the traditional way. It does work for a number of people. I've been around people who just really... you know, feel it in their heart and mind and resonate with it immediately. But that's not true for everyone. So curiosity leading to a natural investigation of what's going on. An investigation of dhammas. Dhamma is one of those words that's a little bit tricky, because it means several things. It means the Buddha's teachings, the Dhamma, usually represented a capital D, Dhamma. But it's also meant for phenomena in general, particularly for mental phenomena, for mental events. So curiosity about an investigation of dhammas could be investigation of the Buddha's teachings, or it could be just investigating what's going on in the mind. Just being curious about and investigating what is this thing that we call awareness, consciousness, knowing. One of the things that can happen with any kind of sustained investigation, a focus of awareness, a focus of one's attention and intention, is that energy comes up, which is convenient because the third factor of awakening is, the Pali word is virya, and it's generally translated as energy. It's also sometimes translated as diligence or perseverance. There is a connotation about sustaining to it, not only having energy, but sort of sustaining an energy. So, and saying that placing your attention and investigating leads to energy is a very, you can think of it as being like the martial arts statement that energy follows attention. When you place your attention on something, energy goes there. There may not be energy in other places in your life, but if you pay close attention to something, there's a lot of energy in that attention. So an interesting aspect of this diligence quality of virya is that we can be curious, but if we're too much of a dilettante, we can get stuck in jumping from practice to practice. We all know people who, and nowadays, because it's the big thing, practice mindfulness for 6 weeks, and then they go on to Scientology or healing crystals or aromatherapy or something else. We all have friends who, every time you meet them, they've got something new going on. And the thing about any practice is practices don't work instantaneously or as if by magic. They take effort, they take some diligence, some application, and they take time. There are times when you feel like your practice is really stuck. These times can last a long time. I mean, this for me, this meditation thing, it's like, I've been at it for 15 years, and, you know, sometimes it just really feels like it's going nowhere. So, you know, I'm going to give it another decade, maybe two, and then I'm just quitting. But for a lot of people, there's just this quality of jumping around rather than being willing to try something long enough to really give it a chance to work. So the thing about sustaining energy and keeping attention on something is that something interesting happens. Something that the Pali word is piti, and it's usually translated as joy or rapture. And there's sort of two ways that we can look at that. And one is, some people say that this is just as in rapt attention. You know, we've all heard that, enrapt, that the audience was rapt. And there is this quality of really being focused on something so much that a certain kind of joy arises. People who paint talk about this. We have a friend who is a painter who says she doesn't need to do concentration meditation because her painting does much the same. And in a way, it does. I was a programmer for many years and then managed programmers, and computer programming is much the same way. I loved it. I would just get completely lost in it and everything else would fall away. It was a great pleasure. And some years after, I had been a manager for a while, and a friend of mine who was one of the programmers who was reporting to me came to me on Monday and said, "Bill, I was here all weekend programming. I slept about 5 hours. I didn't eat. I didn't bathe. I took bathroom breaks every now and then. It was wonderful." And I envied him because I knew what he was talking about. I knew about that space that he'd been in. So when you're engaged in something that's going on in the practice or in meditation, there is this, I don't know if joy is exactly the right word, but there is this absorption quality, not the same as the absorption in concentration practice. But there's another aspect of this. Piti is used to describe an actual physical joy, an embodied joy, something that you feel not just as a good mood, but throughout the body. Which brings up this one thing that's worth mentioning, is that when in the Buddhist scriptures we talk about the body or the mind, the word that's used is citta. And citta actually means mind and body. They're not considered separately the way they are in Western cultures. So the translations are often a little iffy because it'll say, you know, this is going on in the mind, when in fact they're saying this is going on in the citta, which means it's going on in the heart mind. So I've sometimes gone back to translations, and when you see that, it can actually change the flavor of what's being said in the suttas, when you see it as heart-mind, and see joy as something that arises in the heart-mind, and it's felt in the body. It's not just thinking nice thoughts and going to your happy place. It's a physical sensation. It's complete. Even if it's subtle, it's there in the body and in the mind. Piti, by the way, and I'll talk a little bit more about this, piti is a concentration factor. The nice thing about piti is it can be cultivated. So what I would encourage people to do is be curious about joy. When you feel it, when you notice it, even if it's a subtle pleasure, look for it in the body. What does it feel like? And also notice, are there ways to encourage it? This might work differently for different people or not at all. But for many people, working with the breath in some way can help to encourage PT. I may be getting ahead of myself, but in serious concentration practice, what can happen on a long retreat or when people have been doing concentration practice for a long time over a period of days or less, if they're experienced with this, something happens that practitioners call the sweet breath or the happy breath, where the breath actually starts to get pleasant enough to be quite noticeable. And when that happens, following the breath, which is normally really boring, actually gets very interesting because it's so pleasant. So there is something fundamentally pleasant in the breath. The gratitude practice can also be helpful in kind of kick-starting this. So this is piti, rapture, or joy. The fifth of the factors is an interesting one. The Pali word is pasadi, and it's translated as calm or tranquility. Now, one of the things about this quality is that we've just talked about rapture and joy, which sounds great. You know, everybody can go for some rapture and joy, right? And then we know that the next one, number six, is concentration, samadhi practice, which, you know, can involve all kinds of wonderful things. So people tend to skip over this calm without paying a lot of attention to what's going on here. But the Buddha did put it there, so there must be a reason. So if we experience any kind of joy, either through the sustained attention or through any kind of arising joy or rapture, something that can happen for us is a generation of a kind of confidence, a kind of a calm. But there can still be some residual stress, some agitation. Interesting about piti is that the physical and emotive aspect of it, the joy, can be kind of jittery. And people don't notice that at first, but I'll talk a little bit more about that later on when we talk about concentration practice. So calm or tranquility is sort of trying to find some steadiness, settling down, stabilizing the mind. It's a little hard to go straight from rapture, which is all kind of jazzy, and when it's very strong, it can be even unsettling. And so to get to concentration, we need to settle down a little bit. So just about every time you come in here on a Sunday night and somebody does a guided sit to start the evening, we generally start by focusing on the body, maybe letting go explicitly of some of the things we've been fretting about over the day or, you know, worrying about tomorrow. Focus our attention on the body and just try to settle down. Just try to calm a bit before we turn our attention to the breath. Because for many of us, going straight to the breath, it's just really hard. You go for the breath and, oh, you just slide right off because there's too much stuff going on. So it's really a nice practice to just spend some time settling down. So the calming is an important preparation, if nothing else, for concentration. And calm is just a good thing to be able to call upon. So the sixth of the factors is samadhi, or concentration. And there are two aspects of this. And one of them, well, they're both important. The first one I want to talk about is settling down and focusing to stay with our experience. That is, I talked about mindfulness, and mindfulness is a great thing, but it's really hard to be mindful because the mind just tends not to stay with stuff. You can observe this for yourself. Most of you already have. That if something's pleasant, the mind starts to try to figure out how to get more of it, or how to repeat the experience, how to crank it up. If something's unpleasant, we start thinking about ways to get rid of it, or how to avoid it in the future. Why is this happening to me? If something is neutral, or what we call neither pleasant nor unpleasant, we get bored with it. So we have some aversion there. We want to move on to something else. So the mind just tends to skitter around all over the place rather than staying with the experience of whatever is arising. So concentration practice is where we learn to focus on something really boring, like the breath. Because if you can stay focused on the breath, then you have a tool to help you stay focused on whatever is arising in the moment. It's like building a muscle. It's like weight training. Concentration practice really helps you develop the capability to focus and to stay with the experience, whatever the experience is, good, bad, or indifferent.
Bill? How would you differentiate calm from concentration?
Interesting. Well, calm is just calm. It's just being settled down, steady. So you might be calm when you're reading a book. Or you might be calm when you're, you know, sitting in the park. Concentration is actually is the practice of staying with some kind of phenomena over a period of time. So we typically do it with the breath. There are many ways, many objects of concentration that we could choose. The Goenka method is to do body scans. It's great practice, works really well for a lot of people, just scanning up and down the body, looking for physical sensations to turn the attention to, just noticing the physical sensations without telling yourself a story. There's hearing. You could spend, hearing it can be great, say, in a busy airport lobby, in a waiting room, where there's a fair bit of noise, and yet it's indistinguishable enough so that you don't get caught up in the story. You just hear sort of murmurs of voices and rolling baggage and things. In Vajrayana practices, there's looking at mandalas or visualizing mandalas. People can meditate looking at a flame. There's a lot of different things. I mean, the breath is a really nice one to work with because it has a rhythmic quality that keeps it from getting really difficult to follow. It's portable. You don't have to take a mandala with you or have a candle and matches or things like that. No memorizing to be done, so don't have to worry about mandalas. And the other interesting thing about breath is that it's like a gateway between the conscious and the unconscious. You can hold your breath, or you can hyperventilate. You can do all these things with your breath, but you can be asleep and the breath keeps going. It better. You can be in a coma and the breath will keep going. So it has this interesting quality. And it has the quality also of when you put your focus on it, it tends to be kind of dull at first. There's a great Zen story. Zen teacher is listening to a young novice, and the novice is saying, "Well, I'm trying to follow the breath, but it's really boring." So the Zen teacher grabs the novice by the hair, they're standing next to a well, which is very convenient, plunges his head into the water of the well, and holds it down for a good long while, pulls it up. The novice goes, and the teacher says, "That breath, was that boring?" So concentration is really sustaining the attention on something like the breath for a period of time. So the second factor of concentration practice, besides the fact that it develops the ability to stay with your experience, it really supports mindfulness. I mean, mindfulness is just really difficult to do without the basis of concentration practice. I know people who do it. I have a friend who gets migraines when she does concentration practice. So she does only insight practice, you know, noticing arising phenomena, arising and passing, and doing mindfulness practice, and there are other ways that you can approach it, but it's a lot easier with the concentration practice. Now, there's another aspect to concentration, and that is that there are these states called jhanas. And jhanas are called meditative absorptions. And there's all kinds of issues around them, so I'm not going to talk a lot about jhanas. There is some controversy about them, but I do want to talk about the jhana factors, because there's five of these factors that are useful in concentration, irrespective of the fact that they are components of the jhana experience. So if you do concentration practice, you're likely to run into these factors anyway, no matter what your goals are. And these factors, most of them have interesting ways of tying back into the other enlightenment factors. So there are two factors that Philip has taught a lot about, and they're called vitaka and vichara. And vitaka is the ability to place your attention, or the placing of your attention, and vichara is the sustaining of your attention. Or, as many teachers say, it's like aim and sustain. It's interesting that it's broken up into two factors here instead of just one, like paying attention. So it's broken up into two because actually in deeper states of concentration, sometimes one will fall away and the other will still be there, or one will be stronger than the other. So it's actually quite helpful sometimes to see them as separate entities. So a nice way of thinking about vitaka and vichara, aiming, is, I know one teacher, I think it's Sally Armstrong, likes to talk about, at the beginning of a breath, place your attention on the experience of the breath, and then for the whole exhale, sustain the attention on that breath. And then do it again on the inhale, place your attention on the inhale, and then sustain the attention for the entire breath. So that's a very short-term sustaining and aiming. But it can, some people find this enormously helpful, just as a reminder, to place the attention, aim the attention, and sustain the attention. So when I think about vichara, the sustaining quality, I can't help but think of virya. Remember virya? It's the number three in the factors list. Energy with a sustaining factor. So this kind of energy with a sustaining quality to it reminds, to me, it's connected to and related to vichara. So if you work on your vichara practice in concentration, you are also, in a very natural way, improving your energy practice as well. The third of these factors is piti. Remember this, rapture and joy? Interesting that it would pop up again here as a subset of concentration. Of course, that's what happens in Buddhists with all these lists. If you poke inside of a list, you will find another list. If you look inside of that list, you'll find the first list again. Sort of infinite regression, infinite loop. So piti, joy, is one of those things that arises in concentration practice. I talked earlier about the beautiful breath and how that can come out, and how the beautiful breath can really sustain the concentration practice. And the concentration practice then helps reinforce the joy as an awakening factor. The next of the jhana factors is sukha, which is not a word that we've heard before today. Sukha is usually translated as happiness. And the interesting thing is, why is joy and rapture different from happiness? Some people say that they're just opposite ends, opposite extremes of the same quality. I think it's helpful to think of them as separate entities. Piti is something that's very energetic, almost explosive when it's very strong. It's like a Roman candle, sparkling, tingling, active, almost jittery. It can have a coarse aspect to it, kind of raspy. Sukha is sweet, calm, relaxed. It's often likened to floating in a sea of honey at sunset. So it's much more laid back and relaxed. So when I think of sukha, I think of calm, the fifth factor. So this sukha and calm reinforce each other. Calm, when it's very strong, has a very beautiful quality, more than just being relaxing and restful. And again, the jhana factors, even if you don't practice jhana itself, the jhana factors are useful ways of looking at one's experience and deepening one's concentration practice. So number seven of the factors is upekkha, and that's usually translated as equanimity. And this is kind of a loaded word. People often say, well, why the hell is equanimity there when we just had calm a few slots ago? What, is that the same thing, equanimity and calm? So they're not. So I'm going to tell a story about equanimity. I used to have a VW bug that was legendary. It had been it was a 63 VW bug. It had been in a garage fire. I'd left it in a shop overnight, and the shop burned down. So the paint was all blistered, it was yellow, and then spots where the paint had been burned off. And the taillight, plastic taillight, had melted. So I taped red plastic over it so I had a legal brake light. So I could put a drum set in it. I took the back seat out and put in an old piece of plywood where the back seat had been. The doors filled up with water when it rained. So if I opened the doors, you'd hear them sloshing. It didn't have seat belts. It had lap belts that had been added much later on, because 63, they didn't put seat belts in cars. And everyone knew back then that 6-volt systems did not work. The horn, the wiring to the horn had failed long ago, so I wired up a button in the dashboard. And the button, if the headlights were on and I pushed the button, the headlights would dim to nothing. And even in daytime, that horn sounded so meek. It sounded like some kind of herd animal signaling its submission to the alpha male and to every other beast in the herd. It was really pitiful. This was a sad car. And in early 82, Barbara and I had just started seeing each other, and we were driving up to the Sierra foothills to visit friends up in the Nevada City area. So driving along, I was doing about 50, maybe 60 miles an hour. A line of cars up ahead was stopped at a cross street. And so I saw them ahead. I stepped on the brakes, and the pedal went to the floor. No brakes. So I, fortunately, or I wouldn't be here to tell you the story, there was a shoulder there, a gravel shoulder, and I steered over to the shoulder, and I grabbed the emergency brake, and I sort of grabbed it and then pulled it and let go, pulled it and pulled, sort of feathered it, because I knew that if that steel cable broke, nothing was going to stop me except another car, maybe a tree. So I feathered it, steered over, we had showers of gravel spewing up in the air, and finally we came to a stop, sort of at an angle, because we've been skidding back and forth. People ran up to see if we were okay, and we were. So it wasn't until years later that I realized that what I had, a quality that I had through all that, was I did have equanimity. And I can tell you, as you can imagine, I did not have calm. I did not have one bit of calm. I had a lot of adrenaline. I had plenty of spare adrenaline. I know that, just to explain a little further, the Venerable Adelaio likes the word equipoise instead of equanimity, because equanimity does have this connotation of calm, even though that's really not what it means. Equipoise is better, because it implies a kind of balance. And what I had was balance. I didn't panic, that is, I didn't freeze up and think there was no possible thing I could do. And I didn't choke, that is, I didn't go into, well, what if I did this? But maybe that would happen if I did this. So maybe I should do that other thing instead. What is it that the book used to, you know, I didn't go into overthinking it. I didn't go into underthinking it. I found a middle path, a balanced, focused, correct thing to do. And it worked. I did exactly the right thing. I had equipoise, which surprises me in retrospect because I didn't have a meditation practice, didn't know what equipoise meant, but somehow I had that quality. I like the term balance because it also has this, you can think of it as in a martial art, that when you have balance and you try to achieve balance and somebody, an opponent is attacking you, the opponent, by the very nature of the attack, is out of balance. And in martial arts, you use that imbalance against your opponent. But you can only do that when you are yourself balanced because you are ready to move in any direction. You have all this potential, and the potential can move in any direction. You're ready for stuff when you have equipoise. There's another aspect of this, and I'm going to dip into the Brahma Viharas. See if I have time for this. All right, it's so good. One of the Brahma Viharas is compassion. I'm just going to pick on compassion. There are four Brahma Viharas. There's loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy or sympathetic joy, and equanimity, equipoise. Same word, by the way, upekkha. But I'm going to pick on compassion. I'm going to read it from a cartoon here. This is Canderville. This was from some time back, right after there had been a big train crash. A number of people had been killed. So the main character is talking to his psychiatrist. He says, "All week I've been thinking about the people who got hurt in that train crash." Doctor says, "Of course, you ride the train all the time. It's natural to feel fear when you realize it could just as easily have been your train. Times like this make it hard to ignore that your very next trip home may lead to your never seeing your child again." And then the guy says, "Well, it's not about me, it's about them." And then the doctor says, "It's about you identifying with them. Sympathy is the most selfish emotion there is." Or empathy is actually what he says. Empathy is the most selfish emotion there is. You could put compassion in there instead. And of course, that's not the way real compassion is. But compassion has these qualities that look like compassion, but aren't. Compassion has the near enemy of pity, which indicates sort of a feeling of superiority and, "I'm so glad that's not me it's happening to." So compassion with the self involved can become a very selfish kind of emotion. And we can also see compassion, even when it is a much purer and cleaner compassion, we see people burning out with it. They get sucked into compassion so deeply that they lose all sense of balance. We've heard stories about people who are so compassionate about feeding starving children in India or wherever that they neglect their own children, causing much more harm when they're trying to help people in the abstract, in the distance. They're often harming people who are up close. What's usually taught in the Brahma Viharas is that equanimity, the fourth of the Brahma Viharas, is what keeps you from veering into these extremes, keeps you from going to the near enemies of these qualities. And equanimity, or equipoise, is often very difficult for people to understand because it's easily mistaken for apathy or for indifference, and it isn't. You care, but you keep your balance. So there's the thing about the factors is that the first factor, mindfulness, is good anytime, any place, and helps keep that balance, helps provide equanimity. But the second, third, and fourth ones, investigation, energy, and joy, are energizing factors. They tend to be uppers. And then the last three, calm, concentration, and equanimity, tend to be calming, settling. So that makes them sometimes appropriate or inappropriate, depending on what your situation is. So, here's another from the Samyutta Nikaya. And this is the Buddha speaking again. Now, monks, on any occasion when the mind is sluggish, that is the wrong time to develop calm as a factor for awakening. Concentration is a factor for awakening. Equanimity is a factor for awakening. Why is that? The sluggish mind is hard to raise up by those mental qualities. Just as if a man wanting to make a small fire blaze up were to place wet grass in it, wet cow dung, and wet sticks, were to give it a spray of water and smother it with dust. Is it possible he would make the small fire blaze up? Bhikkhus say, "Now, Lord." That's the best I can do with a bhikkhu voice. Now, on any occasion when the mind is sluggish, that is the right time to develop analysis of qualities, investigation, as a factor for awakening. Persistence is a factor. Rapture is a factor. Why is that? The sluggish mind is easy to raise up by those mental qualities, just as if a man wanting to make a small fireplace up were to place dry grass in it, dry cow dung, and dry sticks were to blow on it with his mouth, not to smother it with dust. Is it possible that he would make the small fire blaze up? Yes, Lord. So, and it goes on. You can figure out the rest of the metaphor. It's still the same, you know, trying to start a fire or dampen a fire. So generally, there are times when you are just feeling kind of sluggish, and that's a good time to bring in sustained energy, curiosity, and joy. And likewise, if you're feeling kind of jittery, kind of edgy, that's a good time to bring in calm, concentration, or equanimity. A tie-in to the hindrances. Two of the hindrances are, one of them is sloth and torpor, which has a wonderful sound to it, and the other is agitation or fear or worry. So again, this is the only place where the factors tie in very directly to the hindrances. So the three energizing hindrances are very good for going up against sluggish mind. And the three energizing factors are very good for going up against the sloth and torpor. Did I get that right? I think I might have mixed them up. But anyway, you get the idea. So the awakening factors versus the hindrances. And I don't want to go too deeply into the hindrances because I am actually running behind for a change. It's often taught that there are correspondences in the awakening factors to the hindrances, and that you can match them up on a one-to-one basis. And that actually doesn't show up in the suttas. It's later teaching. Now, many people teach that and find it very useful. Some of them look like good matches, and others I just don't make sense to me, so I'm not really going to go into detail. But I think the one important thing, and it does show up in the suttas, as I just read, is the whole thing of matching up sloth and torpor to the energizing factors and matching up the calming factors for agitation and worry. And the important thing is that at the end of that sutta, where he does the, you know, starting or dampening a fire, his last line is, and this is very simple, "Yes, Lord, as for mindfulness, I tell you, that serves every purpose." So mindfulness is good in any case, and mindfulness is really good for telling you which of these factors you might want to try to encourage or discourage. So one other factor here that I wanted to bring up is, should these be treated as a sequence or in parallel? That is, the way it's often taught is as a sequence. I just went through a sequence of how one factor leads to another. The Buddha, this is from the Anapanasati Sutta, and how are the four frames of reference developed and pursued so as to bring seven factors for awakening to their culmination? And this is heavily edited. On whatever occasion, the monk remains focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful. Putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world, on that occasion his mindfulness is steady and without lapse. Then mindfulness is a factor for awakening and becomes aroused. He develops it, and for him it goes to the culmination of its development. Remaining mindful in this way, he examines, analyzes, and comes to a comprehension of that quality with discernment. So that's the investigation. Then analysis of qualities as a factor for awakening becomes aroused. In one who examines, analyzes, and comes to a comprehension of that quality with discernment, persistence is aroused unflaggingly. He's using persistence instead of energy. Then persistence is a factor for awakening becomes aroused. In one whose persistence is aroused, a rapture arises. Then rapture is a factor for awakening. Doesn't really explain how that connection works. For one enraptured at heart, the body grows calm and the mind grows calm. Then serenity is a factor for awakening becomes aroused. For one who is at ease, his body calmed, the mind becomes concentrated. Then concentration is a factor for awakening becomes aroused. He carefully watches the mind thus concentrated with equanimity. Then equanimity as a factor for awakening becomes aroused. He develops it, and for him it goes to the culmination of its development. But the Buddha also said, just as monks in a peaked house, all raptors whatsoever go together to the peak, slope to the peak, join in the peak, and of them all the peak is reckoned chief, even so, monks, the monk who cultivates and makes much of the seven factors of wisdom slopes to Nibbana, inclines to Nibbana, intends to Nibbana. So for what that means to me is you can also treat the factors as all being mutually supportive. And in fact, you sort of need to touch on them a little bit all the time to help develop each other. I talk a little bit about how some of them feed back on others. So you can treat this as sort of a spiral or a loop that, like a feedback loop that's self-strengthening, or you can just be aware of how so many of these tie into each other, and occasionally you will see relationships between them that are not at first obvious. So these seven factors of enlightenment, bhikkhus, are the makers of vision, makers of knowledge, promoting the growth of wisdom, free from vexation, leading towards Nibbana. Unfortunately, we don't have time for Q&A, so we can talk a little bit afterwards if you like. So let's let go of the talk, settle down a little bit, and we'll end with our metta practice.